Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2021. I am now here with Frode Midyard. Now, before we begin, I would like you all to notice that I've added the special characters in the Millennial Woes font for the O and D. That was something I did this year, actually just before Millennial started. I thought, well, I've done so much other work, it wouldn't be that much work to add some special characters finally. So I did that for Frode. So there they are. You can see them in the subtitle there. Just a wee bit of work that was put in. Anyway, Frode, welcome back to Millennial.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Woes. And I have to congratulate you because you've really sort of outdone yourself this time. This has been a brilliant Millennial with a great lineup. And you've done great, you know, marketing with the videos and everything. And the setup is very professional. And I think it's brilliant. And I hope the audience also appreciates it accordingly, all the work you've put into this. Because I know a bit about how much work it takes to do one of these things. And so I really appreciate it. And this is, you know, this is, people on the right have always said that they want their own media. And this is it. You know, this is our own media. So I think it's brilliant.
Hold on a second. I'm not sure if this has gone correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, no. I think there might be a fuck up.
Mm.
Let me see. Why would that be? It shouldn't be doing that. Because it is the correct. It might be that it's still processing the Greg stream.
Looks like we're streaming on Odyssey, though.
Yeah.
I mean, if I just go into Odyssey, it looks like we're streaming.
Yeah, but is that the... Let's see this
okay.
one. I think...
Want us to start again?
No, I don't think we need to. I think we can just persevere and it will be okay.
So it says on Odyssey, it says on the live stream on Odyssey, it says Greg Johnson, but when you look at the actual video... Well, now it says my name. Okay.
Oh, there it does. There it does now. Okay. All right, I'll just say that on Telegram. It seems to be working now.
Do I need to tweet it out again or something?
No. It's the same URL. Yeah, this is to do with the way Odyssey does stuff, which is a wee bit confusing. Okay, so now we can start comfortably. So thank you. Thank you for agreeing to appear again. And you were saying that this year you think has been good so far.
I think it's been brilliant. Yeah, I think it's been brilliant. I think it's a brilliant lineup. I haven't been able to watch all of them, but just, you know, looking at the names, it's great. And just the, you know, the professional effort that you've put into it with, you know, the layout and the setup and the announcements and the professional structure to everything. It takes a lot of work. And I think that people who haven't done it themselves, they don't really understand how much work it is behind the scenes, because not only are you personally streaming, I don't know how many hours per day, but then you have to set it up behind the scenes as well and work and schedule everyone. I mean, just scheduling these many people, that takes a lot of work. And that's all I wanted to say, that I think it's important to make people understand that this takes a lot of work. And, you know, this is our own media. This is talk radio for the current year.
Oh, yeah, yeah. One thing is also afterwards, it's about, well, it's 8 hours streaming, but then there's about two, three hours of getting it onto BitChute after that. Mm-hmm. So that's quite tedious. But the work really this year went into the system, the software system for running Millennial, which I started it in 2017. And I've used it every year since, but every year I've sort of expanded it. And this year it draws a lot of graphics automatically. And it also does make an animation, but I decided not to use that this year. So it's an attempt to automate as much as possible so that things do go smoothly. But you're relying on Odyssey, which is, as we just saw, a bit temperamental. So it's a, you know, sometimes it doesn't work exactly as you would want. But I am pleased with, you know, the creation of these graphics and so on. I think it was one thing I missed last year. I thought, because I did the overlay for, but it was the same for each episode. And I thought it would be nice if it could be, if that could be automated so that it was different. It was unique for each guest. So So I did that this year. So it's nice. I think it does make the whole thing seem a bit more professional. And then also there's the NFT and the advert for the NFT, which is played at the end of each stream. And that made me realize I could have done an intro, like a 10, 15 second intro video for each stream. But
that's what I did for the Cameron Festival. I did this sort of intro at the beginning. And I think it sort of helps, you know, okay, now we're started. You know, sort of helps you get into game mode, right?
Exactly. And I of course, with my own videos back in the day, it was obvious to have an intro for each video and an outro at the end. But with live streaming, it never occurred to me to do that because I didn't know how to do it. So, but now I know it's very easy to have videos inside a stream. So absolutely, there will be an intro like next year for each stream. Mm-hmm. So I think you're right that it sets the tone. It creates the atmosphere that you want at the beginning. So, yeah, definitely.
And also the trailer you did what was great, you know, sort of the teaser leading up to everything. I think that's brilliant. Are the things that people, I think that many viewers, they don't think too much about those things, all the work that goes in behind the scenes. Because like when I did the Decameron Film Festival, I didn't have as many guests as you did. You have like 60 guests or something. I had, you know, 40 something, but we were talking about films, which meant that I had to watch a film before every episode. Then I had to do the actual episode, and then I had to sort of download it and then upload it again to all the platforms. And, you know, when we're using these platforms, it doesn't always work the first time. So you just have to sit there for hours sometimes, and it just takes a lot of time. Things like that, you know,
it takes age because obviously while a video is uploading to BitChute, you can be doing other things, but it takes like half an hour to upload one of them.
It's gotten better. It used to be horrible. It used to take hours.
Oh yeah. I'm not even having a go at BitChute there. I just mean because the files are like one and a half gigabytes or something. Yeah. And last night's Semiogog stream was so long. The file was 3.2 gigabytes or something like that. So it's like you're waiting and waiting for this, and then finally it's over, and you know I go to bed. But yeah, it is. But you know, I'm not complaining. It's just it's obviously part of the job. And at this point, I just feel I don't want to speak too soon because it's not over yet, and there are another 12 streams to do after this one, but we're approaching the end now, and I guess we're about, you know, 80% of the way through Millennial at this stage, and I do feel really good about this one. I think that the buzz this year has just been fantastic. I haven't felt like this since 2017, really, when it was the first one that felt really big. I think the buzz this year might even have surpassed that. And that might be to do with all the stuff that's going out on Telegram, all the wee adverts that people could then share around. I'm not sure. But somehow it's actually better than it was last year on YouTube. And I can't believe I'm saying that, and it's not a cope. It does seem to be the case.
I think so. I don't think it's a cope, really, because you're getting great viewer numbers, although it's sort of an off YouTube platform. So that's great. I think your schedule was a bit all over the place last year. So I think for you as doing this, like having the same time every single day probably helps you get into the rhythm and helps you a bit, because it must have been hell, you know, doing it like different times every day, because I mean, your schedule has to be all over the place for that. So I mean, yeah, those just to get the structure going and get the ball rolling, that's invaluable. But yeah, I do think that the transition from YouTube to other platforms, you know, we're in the catacombs, right? And there's a charm to that. And I think it's going great. I mean, they're chasing after us everywhere, but I think we're doing a great job with the tiny resources that we have of playing the game. I mean, they're not shutting us up. We're still out there.
Yeah. So somebody, I can't remember who it was. Oh God, I can't remember who it was. Said that it's like a millennial off YouTube is like a speakeasy bar in the old days during Prohibition. Something that you've got to seek out, and it's sort of underground and secretive. And I did like that. I did like that characterization of it.
It's sort of like when we did the last Scanza Forum. This was in November 2019. We were at this venue, and we were basically under siege because the Antifa was standing outside trying to stop the event. And then they somehow pressured the actual owner of the venue that we rented from. They pressured the owner into trying to throw us out, but we had a contract, so we stayed there. So what they did was they cut the power, right? So they cut the power, so everything went dark. This was in November. This was in Oslo. This was in Norway, so it's dark, right? It's in the winter, so it was dark. And they cut the power, and we still had speeches scheduled. So what we did, we found a long extension cord to some other place that we could plug it in, and then we got a spotlight, put it on the stage, so everything was black, and the spotlight was just on us on the stage, and everyone else was sitting there in the dark, and I had someone in the audience.
Sounds like something from Twin Peaks.
From Twin Peaks, yeah. It's exactly. Someone in the audience said, this feels like we're in the catacombs. We're really sort of, this feels like the real deal. There's a charm to all these things that we have to find alternative ways to do things.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it is exciting. And again, as this came up in a previous stream, I was saying, it's the kind of thing where I can imagine 50 years from now, or they would be doing films about this, about what we had to do, the crazy situations that we ended up in, the cutting corners, the improvising, all of these things that had to be done in order to get to make things happen. And it's a shame because those films will probably not be made. But there are so many stories that could be told about what goes on behind the scenes in this movement.
Well, I mean, I have no doubt at all that future generations will romanticize this era one way or another, right? I mean, that's just inevitable because, if white people exist 200 years from now, if they exist, they will romanticize the resistance, metapolitical movement or whatever. They will romanticize that. They will look back and think it's cool. If they exist, I mean, that's the thing. So absolutely, there's no doubt in my mind that people will look back at this and think that it was pretty cool, because if you just look at the numbers, it's a David versus Goliath proportions. I mean, there's no comparison. I can't think of any movement, even in history, that has had worse odds against them than we, in terms of just money, resources like that. And numbers and just total repression. I mean, you could think of more harsh totalitarian, and this is something that I've talked about a lot throughout the years, that we're going away from the Brave New World soft totalitarianism toward a 1984 more hard totalitarian, more explicit totalitarianism. But even those people who were opposed to the system in those kinds of totalitarian regimes, that was in a more active time. We're in a very passive sort of time now, right? People are more complacent. They are more sedated, going back to the sort of Brave New World type of image, that we're just, ruled through distraction and entertainment. And that wasn't as effectively done in the past. So we're sort of in a new game, and although it's not, you know, on the outside it doesn't look as dramatic, it's more difficult. We're doing harder work now because everyone is against us in a sense, you know. And in another sense, everyone is with us, because if you look at what people actually, when people vote with their actions, the communists don't want to live in multicultural neighborhoods, and the rich people, they definitely don't want to do it. And it's like, so everyone is actually, if you look at their behaviors, you know,
they're radical all agreeing honesty. With us. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you know, radical honesty is, you know, what can you look at with their behaviors? And they're on our side in that sense, because they want to hang out with white. You know, I've told this story before that once in Sweden, I went to this punk rock concert, and it was a punk rock band and a classic Swedish band called Asta Kask. Scandinavian listeners might recognize, and they're basically Antifa. They had an Antifa flag on the stage, and it was just leftists. The entire audience was just leftists, like radical Antifa leftists. But the funny thing is that you'd find more black people on a nationalist event than you would find there, because the only non-white person at the event was, you know, working at the venue, picking up bottles and garbage, right? So there is a huge element of implicit whiteness, even in the people, you know, among the people saying they oppose us.
Yeah, and see, these are the people that we are trying to save and trying to get through to. I'm not, obviously not Antifa. The sort of dregs of the earth, white people, but you know, the junkies and whatever. But the white people who are just lost in a sort of dreamlike state in white subcultures, you know, goth, indie, rave, these things that to you and me now seem quaint. You know, these are things that we would have entertained ourselves with in our teens, but now we know how fucking serious the world is. It seems quaint to me. Like the idea that, goth would be meaningful to me, or new wave music would be meaningful to me. It is nice. I like these things, but they're not meaningful next to the struggle that you and I are engaged in. I mean, it's just trivial. It's completely trivial and indulgent.
Yeah. I mean, I just think that's a part of human nature. I don't think that there has ever been a time, and there will be no time, when everyone is a serious person, right? So that it will always be the case that most people are sheep, and you know, the wolves are attacking them, and we are the sheep dogs protecting them. And you can't even have a society with all sheep dogs, right? You have to have
of course,
to even have a use for people like us wanting what's best for the people, right? So,
to be clear, I wasn't berating the masses for being interested in you know, subculture or whatever. I'm just saying to you and to me, it's almost like I kind of care about them because there's this innocence about them.
Absolutely.
They don't see the wolves just behind them, you know, coming up. And you just want to save them.
Exactly.
But the terrible thing is that they are programmed to hate you for wanting to save them.
Absolutely.
It's just evil.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's one of the things that people make fun of Sweden, for example. People make fun of Sweden because it's the most extreme example of political correctness and so on. But you have to ask yourself, why is it the most extreme example of political correctness? Well, for one, it used to be the most racially homogeneous country on the planet, in the world. Like no country in Africa or anywhere was more racially homogeneous than Sweden. And this is something that, you know, anthropologists wrote about 100 years ago, when you could still write about that in scientific circles, right? So it used to be extremely homogeneous, which meant that it was extremely high trust, which meant that you could trust people. And that also means that because you're not a cynic, you can be taken advantage of for your virtues, right? And that makes it especially offensive. That is what makes it especially offensive. And, you know, I'm from, you know, a very small place, you know, countryside place. I don't have an urban background, right? And that is the case in small places. That they are, people become more cynical when they move to bigger cities because you are more anonymous there. but you have to be a more of a high trust person if you live in a very small community, very small town, because that's how it works. That's how society works. And when you see people who are naive because they're good themselves and they don't expect other people to be sinister, when you see people like that taken advantage of, that just is more offensive. That just,
it's absolutely blood. Disgusting. It's reprehensible. Yeah. You know, and the apex example of this would be that Danish and Norwegian girl going to Morocco and getting raped and beheaded. And you think, why? It's their trusting nature, their good, their kind nature, and you can say it's virtue signaling, whatever. It doesn't matter. Ultimately, it comes from a good place. It's the desire to be a good person. Yes. And that was perverted and used against them. And they ended up having the most horrific demise and death. And it's just absolutely fucking evil. And then another one would be Epstein, who apparently explicitly said that he wanted Nordic girls. Hmm. I mean, it's repulsive to imagine a creature like him, like choosing girls from a menu, and he wants that's the option he's choosing. It's just infuriating.
I mean, it sort of boils back to the classic, small lie, big lie thing, right? The big lie technique, which was, someone, a famous person in history said this, but that, the reason that normal people get taken in by big lies is because when they lie about the little trivial things. It's small little white lies. And so that's what they expect from other people. But if you say that, no, they lied about this thing, and that no one could do that. No one could lie about a thing like that. How could someone lie about a thing like that? And that's how our entire current political society is built. Is built on huge, enormous, big lies. And normal people don't think that those are lies, because they themselves will only lie about the little trivial things because they have a moral compass. They will not lie about huge things because that would make them a shitty person. Yes. But our society is run by sociopaths.
Yeah, and because they wouldn't do it, they haven't done it. So they don't have practice of maintaining a big lie. So they assume that it's impossible to maintain a big lie.
Yeah,
because they don't know any better than that. They think it's impossible to maintain a huge lie. But actually, I think what we've found over the last 2 years, and I guess we can touch on that now, that it's actually quite easy to maintain a big lie precisely because of what you're saying here, that people think the government can't be lying about this. Mm. The international bodies cannot be lying about that. That would be terrible if they were. So therefore they can't be. I mean, but the thing is, the governments have always been lying about mass immigration. You know, one of the things that occurred to me is that quite recently was, I used to think we have to make the powerful see the damage that mass immigration does. We have to make the powerful see that multiculturalism doesn't work. And I just, I think, how can I have been so naive? Of course they know.
Of course.
They know. They already know. It's not a matter of getting through to them. They know, and they have always known. Now,
they're not in their position because they're stupid.
Yeah. Now, obviously, you get the mid-level apparatchiks, which at this point would also include the national politicians, I think. But the people who really are competent and intelligent, who are at the top, they cannot get there, and they cannot operate at that level unless they really do know what's going on at the ground level, how things are playing out. They must have always known about the migrant rapes, about the high crime rates, educational attainment, lack of social cohesion. It doesn't take a genius to work these things out. And now you might say, well, they're so detached, they just go to Davos every year and whatever, but still, it's their job to know and understand what is actually really going on in society. So I don't believe that, because otherwise they simply couldn't, I just don't think they could do their jobs. So they must have known all along. So that means that they have always been lying to us. They have always been misleading us, browbeating, guilt tripping us, and conditioning us against what they know is the truth. So if they've been lying about that, why on earth would they not be lying about COVID-19?
Absolutely. People, you know, people lie all the time, and they lie about big issues all the time. The establishment lies all the time. And we sometimes, we have to, I think we have to make a small distinction between lying and self-deception, because human beings have an impressive ability to deceive themselves if it serves a practical purpose for them. If they are rewarded for something, they will make themselves believe some, you know, anything, basically. But you'll hear this objection that it's too complex. You can't, like, the objection, the generic objection to conspiracy theories, right? That a conspiracy is impossible if it's too big, because it would take too many people to be in on it, and someone would betray them, and it would just collapse just out of sheer numbers, and it's not practical. They can't keep it going. But that's not really true, because people just take the whole issue that we're supposed to believe that races don't exist. Everyone in the world knows that races exist, but everyone in the establishment is saying, no, they actually don't exist. And they know they're lying.
It's such a it's a gaslighting. That's the word I'm looking for. It's a confidence trick, but it's also gaslighting.
Absolutely, it's gaslighting, but it boils down to, and this is something that I've said my entire involvement with the right during the entire time that I've been involved, that humans are not primarily rational creatures. Humans don't sit down and look at the data and then do a calculation in their head and come up with the right answer. No, this is something that William Pierce said when he called them the lemmings. It's not just, oh, the plebs, they're stupid. No, he meant something specific about that, because lemmings follow other lemmings. When people see a problem, they don't first of all think, what is the true answer? What is the right answer? They look to everyone else and think, what is everyone else saying? Because they want to hide in the herd. And yes. And so humans are not primarily rational creatures. They work on behaviorist principles. It's conditioning, basically. I mean, you don't have to believe in behaviorism as a descriptive theory of psychology, but as a form of manipulating behavior, that is what works. It is very simple. It's conditioning, it's rewards, and it's punishments. People know what they get rewarded for, and people know what they get punished for. And as long as you have that, even people who know that they are lying, that they themselves are lying, or that they are doing the wrong thing, they will continue doing it. Just a very simple example with the current corona thing with the vax. I have talked to many people who have taken the vax. I haven't taken it, but everyone, basically everyone, like over 90% of everyone that I've talked to who has taken the vax has not taken it because they think that they need it. Everyone has said, no, I have taken it because I want to go to this concert. I need to fly with my work, you know. I need to keep my job to put food on my table, and I need to fly and to get on an airplane and to travel with my job for my job. I need to take the vax. So it all comes down to incentives. And people are incentivized to go along with this narrative. So yeah, people lie all the time. People lie about huge things. And I don't think it is really a conspiracy of, you know, the protocols of the elders of Zion, that they're sitting around a round table coming up with a sinister sort of thing. That's cartoonish. That's not real. That's not true. That is sort of a literary description, sort of a fictional description of how these things work, but it's more subtle than that. But still, people go along with lies if they are rewarded for doing so, and if they are punished for not doing so. you know, there are these examples of
Sorry, I just thought it's not because there's the cliche of the smoky room where a conspiracy is cooked up, but I thought it's more likely to be a Zoom meeting nowadays. And then I thought, well, that's the protocols of the elders of Zoom.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they do Davos meetings on Zoom these days. I don't know. I don't know. No, yeah. But I mean, I just think it's plain to see, right? I mean, there is this thing in Sweden called Femitolvrörelsen, the 5 to 12 movement. It doesn't matter. It's from the early 90s. A young Swedish girl was murdered by her black boyfriend, and her father, the father of the girl who was murdered by a black, she started an anti-racist organization or a movement. The same thing happened with this Amy Beale in America, I think. She was murdered by blacks. She was like a anti-racist.
I think that was in South Africa, if I recall correctly. I'll Google it. But
yeah, Amy, B-I-E-H-L, Amy Beale. I forget where, I think it was in America, but it's many years ago now. The point being that here's a person who is an anti-racist. She goes to, you know, signal that she's a good anti-racist, goes to a black neighborhood, gets murdered. And, you know, her circle of people, instead of saying the obvious that, you know, maybe we should learn from this example so that other young girls don't end up being hurt. No. They go all in virtue signal because they've been conditioned their entire life to go along with this. So, you know, how much is conspiracy? How much is just, you know, self-manipulation, self-deception? Does it matter? I mean, the bottom line is that people lie about all kinds of things. They lie to themselves, they lie to other people, and they lie not about small issues only, they lie about huge issues if everyone else does it, because the bottom line is that they are not individuals and they're not rational. They are herd creatures and they're emotional and they need the protection of the herd. So if the herd does something, they will do it. And that's why people don't look at, oh, here's the actual fact, here are the logical arguments, and therefore I draw this conclusion. No, they look at what is everyone else doing? What is everyone else saying? That's the conclusion I'm going to reach because I don't want to be a part of this sort of weird fringe movement with, you know, these rational individuals, because, you know, they need the herd. They need the all these people around them because that's how they survive.
Oh, absolutely. One thing I wanted to ask you was a quote from you has been floating around, something you said on a live stream, I think, in the last month or so. Okay. Which was that what we're seeing just now is a revolution from above. This is to do with COVID and the Great Reset. Now, I can't remember how much you and I talked about last year on Millennial, how much we talked about the Great Reset in general, as opposed to COVID in particular. But would you like to give your thoughts on what the Great Reset is? What is going to follow from COVID? What is the plan, at least? What would you say?
Well, I don't know how much there is a plan. I think that the general way in which our elites work is that they are sort of opportunistic. They know how to take advantage of a situation that appears. They don't often create them out of whole cloth. And, you know, we can speculate about where accidents stop and planning begins, right? Is there an agenda? I think that if we're just looking at the situation now, they like power. I've often compared this to ancient Rome, right? In a state of emergency, you could appoint a dictator because you had to have someone in charge of a severe situation, a difficult situation, and the normal means were not enough to take care of the situation. So you could appoint a dictator who could, you know, enforce drastic measures. But that is dangerous because once you have that power, the dictator would not be very willing to give it back, right? So if you gave it back, that would earn you a lot of respect for being a very honest person, a very, very honorable person who would be so strict with himself that you actually gave these powers back to, you know, to the normal system. And if you look at the people governing our society now, you know, if you give them extraordinary powers, do you think they're honorable and they want to give them back? No, I don't think so. You know, and I've compared this to the 9/11 situation. You know, I remember how it was to fly, you know, air travel before 9/11. It was normal. But after that, you know, in a state of emergency because of a terror attack, we had to enforce these security checks. You can't bring liquids on board a plane, and you're basically treated like a prisoner when you enter an airport. And that's now 20 years ago, and things haven't gone back to normal. Because once the people running our society, once they have more power, they are very reluctant to roll those powers back and sort of, yeah, okay, now let's go back to normal. And, you know, when you look at these whole systems with digital IDs and scanners for the QR code on your phone, because to show that you have the vax pass and everything, you don't create that in 2 weeks. It takes a lot of money. It takes a lot of time to create that. And if you create that system of digital IDs where you have to scan your QR code to enter airports and enter, you know, shops or shopping malls, it's, you know, different, varies from country to country, right? Sometimes you have to scan your COVID pass to buy a cup of coffee. But just setting all that up, they're not setting that up just to remove it 2 weeks later. I mean, it costs a fortune. It's a huge investment. So this is not something that, oh, let's just, I mean, just the logistics of it. Just imagine the logistic. I mean, just setting up Millennial is a pain in the ass logistics. Imagine setting up this whole system for the entire planet. It's because they're going to keep it. It's because they want to keep it. So I do think, yes, they want to, the Flu World Order, they wanted to, you know, piggyback on anything. Did they create the virus in order to do this? And I don't think so. I mean, I won't think it until I see clear evidence that that was actually the case. Are they using this situation to create something that has nothing to do with COVID-19, the virus, and the actual dangers involved with getting an infection? Absolutely. This is not, you know, proportionate. This is not in relation to the actual dangers of the virus. So this is something else that it piggybacks on the reaction to COVID.
And it's important to point out that this happened, this started very soon after it was May last year. I recall Klaus Schwab being on TV. That's less than 2 months after the lockdown started. So they did not waste time. And I also think that the lockdown started so as to do this. I think that the lockdowns, all of the, like, I think the initial reaction from national governments was the rational one. Given the threat, I think they gauged the threat of COVID-19 and thought, okay, it's not that much of a killer. It's not that serious a threat. So we'll just go for herd immunity. And then higher powers intervened throughout March. And it's very fast, very fast indeed. Which I don't know when it started, maybe earlier than March, but definitely by the middle of March, you had the whole Western world, almost every country except for Belarus and Sweden, going into lockdown. I don't know how that was done. It seems incredible, but given, and I know that someone could say, listen to what you're saying. How could they possibly send people to every country to liaise with every government and successfully persuade them? Don't you think it's more likely that the national governments were doing the rational thing? But no, because they weren't doing the rational thing.
No. No, they weren't.
Clearly they weren't.
I'll give you a clear example of how they did not do the rational thing. Sweden has... Okay, so let's just roll things back a little bit. I believe that the right attitude to have toward these things is evidence-based. We look at the evidence and then we draw our conclusions. I don't like what some people do. They just jump the gun and then they just say immediately, no, it's all a lie. It's just, you know, it, because the most precious thing you have as a current events commentator or a metapolitical movement or anything like that, the most precious thing you have is credibility. The most precious thing you have is credibility. That's why I did, for example, I did during this year, I did 3 episodes with JF Garipi, and we did fact-checking the pandemic, where we sort of debunked various claims made by both the sort of the pro flu world order, you know, just towing the party line people, claims made by them, and claims made by the most sort of speculative, yeah, exactly. The people who just will reject anything that the establishment sends, sort of knee jerk reflex, and say that this is, you know, the spike proteins and everything. This is a time bomb. They're just gonna, you know, they're trying to murder everyone. So basically, we try to, okay, let's look at the evidence, because that's the important thing. Because if we people who are a part of the establishment and who toe the establishment party line, they can afford to be sloppy. We can't, because we will be scrutinized under a microscope. Everything we say will be scrutinized under a microscope, and they will attack us on all our weaknesses in everything we say. So we have to have that credibility. We have to be able to back it up. That's why, you know, yeah, they can say things and they can speculate. We can't afford to do that. So basically, my point by saying this is that what I did in the early days of the COVID pandemic, I suggested that, okay, there's an outbreak in China. We don't know what it is. So we have a huge unknown here. What is the rational thing to do? We see that, you know, China is locking people up in their houses, and they're freaking out because of this. And that wasn't just, you know, the videos online. You know, people saw these sort of weird videos, extremely sort of alarmist videos. I also know people who were in China and were living through the thing in China before it came to Europe, and they were telling me, holy shit, everything is empty. We can't leave the house. You know, Europeans who had moved there for various reasons. So that happened. And then people, you know, Swedes or other Europeans working in China, going back to Europe, said that there's a virus outbreak here. Excuse me. There's a virus outbreak here. I'm coming into Europe from this province where there's an outbreak. Do you want to run some tests on me before I enter the country? And they said, no, just come back. Just come back. This went on for like 2 months after we knew about the outbreak. And they said, oh, no, let's come back. And Dominic Cummings, who was the advisor to Boris Johnson during this period, there was this hearing with him a few months ago. I think it was like in the summer. And he said that, no, you know, the groupthink at the time was that closing the borders would be racist. Closing of the borders would be racist. And it's like, okay, yeah. I think that, you know, the prudent thing to do when you have a big unknown threat is, yeah, I would think it advisable to close the borders before it gets into the country. Because that will possibly buy you some time to study what it is, so that eventually you'll have more knowledge, so that you can have a fact-based, knowledge-based reaction to the threat, right? So I said that that would be a rational thing to do, but I fear that if they actually start any lockdown, they will not go back on it, because that they are corrupt. Because they are not on our side, they are corrupt. So there's a huge danger, but just from a rational standpoint, that would be the logical thing to do. They didn't do that. They waited months until people were infected, and then they closed the borders. Sweden has been open all this time, and now they're closing the borders. Now, when the pandemic is over, basically. I mean, the new variants, Omicron,
that's
and all of that.
That's insane.
Exactly.
And even especially when we know, it seems very... I'm not going to say certain, but it seems very likely that Omicron is not as serious as previous versions of the virus.
Yeah.
I think the statistics 70% less fatal or something like that.
Yep. Absolutely. So I mean, that's just one very simple example that everyone should be able to see where our governments have not been rational. When they had the opportunity to close the borders right away when they knew about the breakout in China, they didn't close the borders. They waited until people are infected in the country, and then they close the borders. But everyone is already infected. What's the point of closing the border when, you know, closing the gate when the horse has bolted, or whatever the expression is? That is insane. It's just stupid. And you know, that is just an example where you don't have to go into a conspiracy or anything. You can just point that out to people. Okay, they refused to close the borders. They got all the warnings. They refused to close the border for months. And then, you know, when everyone was already infected, now we have to close the borders in perpetuity, you know, for the rest of time, we have to close the border. When closing the border is no, there's no point in it, because the virus is already inside the country. So why are we closing the borders? No one knows, but we're just doing it.
And there are so many other things, like the PCR tests are very unreliable. The masks don't work. Yes. The vaccine doesn't seem to be very effective, certainly. And also, but the key thing, and I said this last year as well, the absolute key thing is that the virus simply isn't that dangerous. 99.6% survival, at least. And if you're under 80, then it's much higher than that. All of this is ridiculous. And all of this could have been noted as ridiculous, recognized as ridiculous, at any time from March last year, when we went into lockdown, to now. Yeah. But instead, they're amping up the rhetoric and getting... I mean, the stuff I insulate myself from the mainstream media to a great extent. And so whenever I see it, whenever it intrudes upon my life and I see what most people are being subjected to in the way of newspaper headlines, the rolling ticker thing on the BBC News, I'm stunned at how crass it is, how obviously designed to fearmonger and induce panic all of this is. Yeah. It's clearly that, you know, as I say, at any time they could have gone back on it, even saved face. They could have done, you know, they could have done it in, we did what we thought was necessary at the time. It was the only, we were being responsible. You might think it was an overreaction, but we
better safe than sorry.
Exactly. They could have done it without and save face, but instead they have chosen to double down. So that to me indicates that this is a revolution from above. It is deliberate and it is very elaborate. And then you can see why. You can see who is benefiting from all of this. And it's Big Pharma, global corporations, Amazon, Big Tech, and these international governance institutions like the WEF and so on.
Yeah. So I did a video, I think it was in the fall, a few months ago, maybe in September or something like that. And I called it Dr. Moreau's Panic Button. And if you've seen The Island of Dr. Moreau from, you know, the 90s, well, there are several versions, but...
I've seen that. It's with, you've seen it? Val Kilmer and...
Marlon Brando.
And it was regarded as a complete disaster of a film. But I remember watching it and not thinking it was that bad. But, you know, I was 12 then or something. So.
But Dr. Moreau, and I actually did on the last Decameron, I did a show with David Cole about the film. But I did a separate video just called Dr. Moreau's Panic Button. And... in the film, Dr. Moreau is a mad scientist. He's a liberal, and he wants to create an island. He has selected an island, and on this island, he wants to create a utopia. So he basically creates genetically engineered creatures. And what he wants to do is he wants to eliminate basically all fascist tendencies from these creatures. They have to be vegetarians. They have to be sort of domesticated. They're not allowed to be aggressive. Not allowed to eat blood, because that might awaken, you know, the primordial nature in these creatures. So he has to tame them, and he has to create them to be sort of a liberal utopia, basically. But there is a little problem that you know, it might happen that these creatures get a taste of blood and then they become animals again, and then they might revolt against their masters. So he has, in all these creatures, he has implanted a little microchip in their head, and he has a panic button that if they show aggression against him, he can hit the panic button and subdue the animals. They get an electric shock and they're subdued, and the threat is eliminated against Dr. Moreau, this sort of liberal utopia creator, mastermind, mad scientist. And basically our elites are mad scientists because they want to create a liberal utopia. Instead, they've created a hellish society where we're supposed to accept that terrorism is part and parcel of living in our cities. You know, we're supposed to accept that. And of course, people, you know, might be slightly reluctant to accept that as just an element of living in a city, because they've created a pressure cooker where you've mixed all kinds of people in, and people are tribal. They're hardwired to do that. So you create conflict that way. And of course, you know, this is just never-ending chaos. It's, you know, leading to basically low-intensity civil war all over Europe. It's just become not a civil society anymore. And so what do our elites need? Well, they need Dr. Moreau's panic button, because when everything just gets out of hand and gets too violent, they need to be able to control people. And of course, they might see the use of having this mechanism for seeing where everyone is, a total surveillance state. Because, let's face it, the more natural and normal a society is, the freer it can be. You can have a society that is free and normal and open if it's in line with human nature. But if you're trying to force society to go the opposite way, to go against human nature, then you need more force. You need more control, right? So I'm not saying all of this because I think that, you know, all the elites got together to plan this, you know, as Dr. Moreau's panic button. But I do think that it's very simple for someone who wants to create a system like this, a control system, to sell it to the elites and say that this is actually a very useful system. And, you know, when COVID is over, we might use it for other purposes. Because, like I said, it's super expensive. It's a pain in the ass to create the system, the sort of surveillance system, and they're not going to roll it back afterwards. There was all in the Norwegian state media a few weeks ago. I posted this on my Telegram. They said that, you know, even irrespective of COVID, we might still continue with the restrictions because there's the RS virus, there's the flu, and there's, you know, so like, okay, so this is the new normal now. you're just going to continue doing this even if COVID is not a threat anymore. And we've seen, as in Sweden has been open for 2 years now when everything else has been closed, and now they have actually started with the COVID passport when the pandemic is over, when, you know, the threat is reduced even beneath the previous whatever threat it was, right? So yeah, there's irrational things from that point of view.
Yeah, it's like if you were constructing something from blocks, and you might insert a temporary block underneath so as to lift something up so that you could work with it, and then eventually you can take that support block out, and the structure will stay. COVID functions as that support block. It's that temporary thing that, you know, is needed. But then you work on the infrastructure, and then COVID can disappear, and the structure will remain. It's it remains justified because you built it, and it's useful for other purposes that might well come up in the future. Another virus, another pandemic, or terrorism, or God knows what, hate speech. And they're calling everything hate speech now.
Of course.
Yeah. I mean, so
this is one of the early things that I pointed out. And this was actually something that I pointed out during the first interview I did with JF on fact-checking the pandemic, that when Michael Yeadon became a name, you know, everyone heard of Michael Yeadon, who was this guy who used to work in medicine development. And when he said that, you know, he doesn't support the vaccine rollout and everything, Reuters you know, the huge, the, probably the biggest news agency in the world, Reuters, they had a sort of a fact-checking article about him. And who did they interview for the fact-checking article about the scientist Michael Yeadon? They did not interview, you know, his colleagues saying that, well, I disagree with Michael Yeadon for this and that and the third reason. No, they interviewed some colleagues who said that I'm very disappointed in Michael Yeadon. They never pointed out what's actually wrong. And then they interviewed some, he had some Arab sort of sounding name, from the something for countering digital hate. That is like a watchdog, like ADL, a similar type of organization for countering digital hate. Now, what the hell kind of expertise did that gentleman, who was the spokesperson for this this watchdog group, what kind of medical expertise does he have to say that Michael Yeadon is wrong? No, they interview because it signals that, okay, that's a bad guy. That's a bad guy. You're not supposed to associate with him.
This would have been unthinkable in the 90s, to answer a medical criticism with a political or social or expert. It would have been just obviously ridiculous. You cannot say that a scientist and a biological argument is hateful. It's either true or it's not. It's either accurate or it's not. Hate has nothing to do with it. That's ascribing emotional motives to what, and you know, human beings do have emotional motives, of course, but you're ascribing emotional motive or truth. I don't know how to articulate this, but you're saying that scientific truth is actually governed not by evidence and logic and whatever, but by how we feel about it, which is ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, this is something that the left used to be honest about. You know, people like, you know, like the Frankfurt School and like the sort of the post-war left, when they when it became sort of an academic thing, sort of a cultural revolution, they actually, and this is something that Marx said. This is something that is directly from Marx. Marx said that, you know, hitherto philosophy has been about describing reality. Philosophy should be about changing reality. So they can take certain liberties, right? And so the left, when they infiltrated, and this is, you know, what the Frankfurt School and other sort of post-Marxists did, they infiltrated our academic world, and they pushed out their competitors. And of course, and it's sort of in a similar way that, you know, our society works when dealing with certain other more tribal people, shall we say, that we think as individuals and we're just looking for the truth, and we're just, and they think as a group, they work through nepotism and they want to push everyone else out. And this is something that Kevin MacDonald talked about, for example, with Franz Boas in anthropology, you know, when it became, now it's supposedly, you're not supposed to think that races exist. Well, this is because Franz Boas and his colleagues, they pushed everyone else out of the discipline at universities. You're not allowed to work if you actually have an opinion that goes against theirs. So they made it into sort of this political and tribal struggle in academia and science. So this is something that they've been doing for a long time. But yeah, it goes directly back to Marx. He says it explicitly. Philosophy is not about discovering reality or truth. It's about changing reality. His followers are doing
and I guess that would lay the groundwork for moral relativism and cultural relativism.
Absolutely.
And you do get this. I mean, there was another example that, oh yeah, the field of psychoanalysis and psychiatry. I know that that was heavily tribalized in the early 20th century as well, because basically you were a Freudian or you were nothing. The late 19th century.
The authoritarian personality. If you have normal mental traits that are adaptive for your people, then you're mentally ill. You're supposed to be maladaptive. You're supposed to be transsexual or gay. You're not supposed to like your parents. You're not supposed to, this is exactly what it is. It's the authoritarian personality. They slander people who have normal values that are adaptive, that will lead to the survival of their people. If you have traits, cultural traits, behavioral traits that will lead to the survival of your people, then you're sick, and you're sick in the head. it's what they did. And, you know, it's another example of how naive we are, our people. We actually accepted this shit. You know, people should have been, they should have been pissed off. Let's just leave it at that.
They should have been aware. They should have had their eyes open.
They should have said that we're not going to take this shit. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm mad as hell.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly. They, if only they had been aware enough. But again, it goes back to the state of European societies at that time. Presumably, yeah. European societies in the future, if such things exist, will be much more red-pilled on certain issues, on the threat from outgroups, even outgroups who seem really nice.
This is what Kevin MacDonald says, basically, that the reason, you know, one of the reasons, but the thing that he talks about just from a biological point of view is that we developed in cold climates in Northern Europe, in the Ice Age. The biggest enemy that we had to deal with was nature. We had to deal with nature. It was cold. We had to survive cold winters. They didn't have electricity back then. It was very difficult to survive. So they had to have a sort of a very objective mind dealing with that. And they dealt with people on a more individual basis because it was sparsely populated. It wasn't densely populated, this area of the world. So you had to deal with individuals. And you had to deal with harsh nature. That was the biggest threat, harsh nature. We're going to cooperate as individuals against nature because that is the killer. That's what's going to kill us. So if we want to survive, we have to cooperate against nature. In the Middle East, they had a different threat. Their biggest threat wasn't nature per se, it was other tribes. So they evolved to deal as tribes against other tribes. That's how they evolved to deal with external threats. External threats were from other tribes. So they developed through evolution a skill to deal with other tribes. Now, what I believe will happen is not pretty. I believe that we are looking at, and I've been saying this for many years, that I believe we're looking at an evolutionary bottleneck. I don't think there is such a thing as saving the white race, saving the West, or anything like that. I think a huge portion of our people are just going to go extinct because they are too naive. They will not face reality. But it means that the people who make it through this evolutionary bottleneck and come out on the other side will be a bit more savvy on how to operate in a more sort of multicultural society or whatever, because they will understand that tribal nepotism is a necessary means of survival.
I also suspect that there'll be a lot less conformist. I think that, and you know, that this might be a wish fulfillment for me, but I suspect that the most conformist people are the ones who go along with multiculturalism up until the point when they are literally being raped and beheaded, yeah. Or they're the ones who will.
And go some won't even react then. Sorry.
Yeah. Or they're ones who will go along with medical tyranny up until the point when they are, you know, vaxxed to the eyeballs and their immune system is confused and whatever, and they are no longer able to even deal with the common cold or the common flu, whatever. I think that there are all sorts of people who will go. I mean, you see it, you know, white hipsters who put up with multiculturalism, celebrate it because that's what they think they're supposed to do. I've seen it in my own generation, the millennials. It's an incredible weakness brought about by the need to conform to consensus, incredible personal weakness, I mean, and personal corruption brought about by the need for social acceptance. I suspect that part of this remixing of our gene pool would be that a lot of those people will just be absent. They'll exit the gene pool.
Yep. They will be filtered out. And because we have, you know, you can debate how much is culture, how much, you know, how much is nature, how much is nurture, how much is culture, how much is just biological heredity and all of this. But the point is that liberalism, let's just call it, you know, as a sort of an umbrella term, liberalism, the current political paradigm. It's a creation of Northwestern Europeans. And we have no reason to expect that everyone else in the world wants to live according to those cultural standards, right? And so we shouldn't be surprised that when the percentage of Northwestern Europeans goes down in society and more Black people, more Asians, that will change how society works. You know, there was this humorous thing during the BLM riots and everything in, I think this was in Seattle. I think this was last year when the city government sent out a letter to their employees saying that, well, you have to stop expecting white norms. You have to stop expecting that you're going to walk around on the streets and be safe, that, you know, that your workplace is going to be quiet. Those are white norms. And it's sort of like, okay, so you're basically agreeing with us that everything we like and enjoy is a white thing. But that was basically what they said. And this is true. You know, they were right. That, yeah.
It's one of these cases where it's okay if they say it, but if we say it, it is the most evil racism.
Exactly. And but yeah, I mean, what they said was completely true. I mean, if you don't want a white society, well, you're not going to get white norms. You're not going to get white cultural traits. This is something that I've said for years, that liberals or leftists, they want to go swimming, but they don't want to get wet. You know, they want a multiracial society, but they don't want what comes along with a multiracial society. They want pro-social attitudes and traits, but they don't want the necessary precondition for having pro-social attitudes in a society, which means caring for others, not individualism. You actually care about your community and all those things that you're supposed to do if you're a leftist. But the reason those things came about in the first place was because that they were adaptive in a racially homogeneous society. They're not adaptive in a multiracial society. So in a multiracial society, those traits go away, right? There's liberals love Scandinavian style socialism. Why the hell did that appear? Because it's the most racially homogeneous place in the world. It used to be that. That's why it worked, because people are prepared to pay taxes if it goes to other people like themselves, not if it goes to some person who is not like them. And this is something that, you know, if you need any evidence for this from a sort of social science point of view, there are so many examples. Frank Salter has written about it. Robert Putnam has written about it. E Pluribus Unum is his famous paper on that topic, for example. But there are many examples. But the point is that they want a society, but they don't want the necessary conditions for creating that society. And so they're stuck, you know. They're stuck with this sort of utopian bullshit thinking that if I just wish it, it will be so. No, because there's a reality out there, and you have to look at that reality in order to figure out how to create the kind of society you want.
Oh, absolutely. I think that in all sorts of ways that we've seen a flight from honesty, a flight from reality over the last 100 years, and you now have things like that are really dysgenic, like that guy, the Norwegian guy who was raped by a migrant and he felt guilty that the migrant was going to be deported, or the judge who refused to deport a Somalian rapist who'd raped a Swedish woman, and he said, well, why should we endanger Somalian women by placing this man back among them? Why are Somalian women worth less to us than Swedish women? Yeah. I mean, this kind of absolutely dysgenic, not just dysgenic, nihilistic.
I think it's a psychopath. Attitude. I think it's a psychopath. I mean, it's like saying that if you have a child and you care about sort of an abstract child on the other side of the planet just as much as you care about your child, then you are defective. You're mentally defective. You are a sociopath because you don't just care about these whatever principle. That makes you a monster. If you don't care about your own children and your relatives more than just a random person on the other side of the planet, then you're a crazy person and you're sick. Yeah. I mean, you're a sociopath. I wouldn't want to associate with people like that.
Oh, it'd be very bizarre if you realized that you were talking to someone who literally cared no more for their own child than they do for some stranger across the other side of the world.
Absolutely.
That would be very scary. This is in a way the attitude that's demanded by the centrist, the individualist, because for slightly different reasons than the leftist, but they also want everyone to have no group identity. They mock that idea. They laugh at the idea that we should care about our group. And again, I think this is a luxury of, I think it just comes about by too much luxury. The fact that we have people who are able to think in such terms so divorced from reality. And actually unpleasant terms, because they feel good about themselves for thinking this way. They think they're sophisticated. It's the Jordan Peterson kind of thing. But really, who the hell would want Jordan Peterson around if your village is under attack and he's saying, "Oh no, we've got to let them in." I mean, you'd kill him. Frankly, you would kill Jordan Peterson because he's clearly in that situation.
That's a good soundbite.
He would clearly be an evolutionary disadvantage to have in the community because he would be undermining, and this is exactly what he's even said this, that he's proudest that he has undermined nationalism. But that's exactly what he would be doing in that situation. He'd be looking for ways. In fact, it's even worse than that because he would be actively looking for ways and reasons to give in to the invader. In the same way that with the guy Kavanaugh, he was looking for a rationale for the right to give in to the left. Because then that would make us the better people. So it's just rationalizing weakness and defeat. I mean, that, and ultimately that seems to be what centrism results in. Again, I would think of Sargon on the Academic Agent stream a few months ago saying that couldn't we just write the immigrants a letter asking them not to come?
please don't. Yeah, I mean, please, Mr. Muhammad, I think you would find that if you look at these graphs, if you look at these statistics,
It's absolutely crazy. But the thing is that they don't, like people like Sargon and Jordan Peterson, deep down, they don't want these immigrants coming here because they know it's going to mess everything up.
Then they would live with them.
But they don't have the backbone to say that. So it has to be some other rationale. It has to be weakness rather than strength that gets them through. Mm-hmm. This is pathetic.
Yeah, I mean, it's... It's sort of silly. It's silly. What do you call it? Like just mind games. It's philosophical thought experiments. It's thought experiments. What if? I mean, if we take an abstract person and think that we could talk to him and tell him to do this and that. Well. If this abstract person would do it, why would this other abstract person not do it? Well, that's not how people are. People are not abstract units, right? They are actual flesh and blood human beings.
And this is a big thing with the centrists.
They have genetics. Yeah.
This is a big thing with the centrists. They require people to be abstract units that just operate on logic and values and principles.
Yeah.
But they don't. No. When it comes to it, people protect that which is valuable to them. Regardless of principles, actually. It's interesting that the people who crow so much about principles end up being really quite unprincipled in reality when something that they value is under threat, like their YouTube channel, for example.
I mean, like I said, it's a thought experiment when they get up from their computer where they've been writing all day or ranting. They get up from their computer and then they go out and interact with other human beings. They become normal again. You know, it's sort of like Edmund Burke. There's this quote from him because he's this. He has these ideas, philosophical ideas about how reality really doesn't exist. Let's just put it like that: reality doesn't really exist, right? Because it's all just ideas. But when he gets up from his armchair. And he's done with his philosophy and he goes back to playing backgammon or whatever, And he starts believing in reality again, because that's what he has to deal with. So, I mean, I don't really see the use in these thought experiment political ideologies, because they have nothing to do with the situation we're in. Yeah, you can make that thought. You can write that novel if you like. But so what? I mean, you can create a novel, and in Game of Thrones, these people have these characteristics, but it has nothing to do with reality, and that's just what it is. It's a fictional game that they are creating, and they're just they're owning the libs by, well, I've created this game. It's sort of like, well, what if I wanted a nuclear power plant in my backyard? That's the sort of libertarian bullshit. So what? I mean, it's that thought experiment has no relevance for the society we're actually in. It's just
libertarianism.
It's just autistic Sudoku.
Exactly. Libertarianism is such a joke, and I've railed against it many times, so I don't need to do it now. But you're right that it's autistic. It's autism. It's autistic wankery. It's this. Yeah. Well, what if human?
It
beings,
is mental masturbation. That's the only thing. Yeah.
Human beings should be like this, and I remember getting into this debate with a guy IRL, who was, and he was probably a perfectly well-meaning guy, but he was saying, it was really interesting actually. He said, he was a libertarian, and he was like the chair of some libertarian society somewhere, and he was saying to me how frustrating it is that he can't get ordinary people interested in libertarianism. And he said, you can outline the benefits to them. You can list the benefits that they can have more freedom and independence, and they're just not interested. And I remember thinking, well, doesn't that tell you something about the human condition? And indeed, this was pre-COVID, actually. I think it was 2019. Well, what we've seen since then has vindicated me and completely rubbished. I mean, I don't know how anyone could be a libertarian at this point. It's so obvious that in order to get things done in the world, the world is animated by positive forces which want something. And you actually have to, this idea that you can step out from the power game and just be an individual and be on your own, be the desperado, is completely delusional. I mean, what will happen then is that you will get buffeted, you'll be the plaything of those who are not afraid to wield power.
It is libertarianism and all these things, this sort of intellectual mind games, it's just a sort of a game of validating my imagination. And there's not a huge difference really between libertarians basing their politics on these thought experiments. There's not a huge difference between that and the sort of the transsexual saying that I'm born in the wrong body, validate my idea that I'm born in the wrong body and give me surgery. Or I mean, I could say that, well, I actually believe that, why can't I be the fastest runner in the world? The government should give me cybernetic legs so I can just run. what's the point of these thought experiments? It's just sort of validate my imagination. They're like children. But I mean, the only function that libertarianism has is that it gives people a polite way to opt out of society. I mean, it's like saying that, okay, I don't want to be part of this crap that is out there in reality, so I'm just gonna, it's sort of like playing a video game or whatever. It's a form of escapism. You can play Dungeons and Dragons or you can be a libertarian. It's all just autistic imagination. That's what it is.
It's wish fulfillment fantasies and mental masturbation about how things could be if the human species were different. Well, they're not. It's not different. No. You're stuck with the human species as it is here and now today. So what are you going to do with that situation?
Yeah. If you want to be a serious person, you have to deal with empirical evidence. I mean, if you don't want to deal with induction, right? If you don't want to deal with induction, which is just gathering information about known examples and then drawing conclusions from that. It's sort of like if you burn your hand on the stove and you try it again and again and again, well, you're a nutcase, right? I mean, you have to learn from induction. Well, why can't the stove not be hot? Well, it isn't. So either you burn your hand or you don't. I mean, it's so you just have to gather evidence about outside reality. If you just want to sort of disappear in your own sort of philosophical idealism, be my guest, you can do that. But you're just going to end up being hurt in the process and hurting other people as well, probably, because you're going to base your actions on fantasy rather than reality.
Yeah, and I think that doesn't work in the realm of politics. In the realm of somebody, like someone's own life, I think that it's, in certain circumstances, delusion can actually be useful. And you can get through life with delusions. I'm not saying that is the case with every person and with every stage in their life. But either way, delusions can, to some extent, be tolerated and possibly even be beneficial in someone's yes. life. But when it comes to society, those who wish, as I said earlier, those who wish to run, to rule society, have to be very hard-nosed about how things actually are. Because otherwise, reality will just constantly interfere with their best laid plans.
I think a lot of very successful people are delusional about their own abilities, or they have a delusional form of self-confidence. But I also think that a person with delusional self-confidence will outperform a person who is shut down and depressed and doesn't think that he has any abilities. Because the person who is depressed will not try anything, will not do anything. Whereas the person who thinks that anything is possible, he will try something, fail, get knocked down, get up again, try it again, get knocked
Absolutely.
Down. And that is, you know, that is what, you know, all these successful people like Henry Ford and, you know, all these sort of quotes from successful men, they say that, well, basically success to a large extent boils down to be able to take failure and just do it again. Just go again and again yeah. and again. Because there is, I mean, you can't rationally calculate things beforehand. You have to try it. It's an yeah. empirical game. You have to yeah. just try it. But if you never try, if you just say, well, I think that I have a less than 50% chance of succeeding, well, you're not going to do anything. You're going to be a depressed person, clinically
yeah.
depressed.
Yeah. And, you know, we can make fun of Dunning-Kruger, the Dunning-Kruger effect. And we do. It's something that comes up quite a lot about how the midwit meme is hilarious. But yes. the fact is, look at the number of midwits who only get anywhere in life because of the Dunning-Kruger effect. So they actually do take the risk because they think, you know, they're deluded enough to think that they've got a good chance. But yeah. that means that they do then have a good chance. Because
exactly.
those
right.
who are, yeah, it's funny because those who are more realistic wouldn't even try. Yeah. And this is, I think, how you end up with corporations and organizations full of people who really don't deserve to be there, really shouldn't be mm. there. But they are there because those who are more deserving didn't even try. I've known quite a few people, I'm sure you have as well, who were damned talented, damned intelligent, but they didn't have the drive. That's one thing. Or they didn't have the self-belief. They were down on themselves, or they were too pessimistic, and so they didn't even try. And so, and there was a famous quote from someone saying that, you know, there are plenty of geniuses who you never hear about because they never achieve anything because they never try. You know, drive is essential.
You know, I coined this term probably last year, or maybe earlier this year, the Eeyore, right? Eeyore from Winnie the Pooh, right? The depressed donkey. And there are so many people on the right, people in general, but I've encountered a lot of people on the right who have a high intelligence, but they seem to have a low testosterone level. So the combination of high intelligence with low testosterone will mean that they're going to use their intelligence to rationalize their own self-hatred, self-doubt, failures. So they're just going to rationalize why there's no point in anything. Because why not just be depressed? What's the point? I mean, you can rationalize that. You can, and that's the thing with IQ. I mean, IQ isn't good or bad. It's a tool. It's like an engine on a car. I mean, if you have a powerful engine, you can go fast in one direction or another. But you can go fast into a wall, or you can go to a suitable destination, and that's basically it. People who have a high IQ have a higher ability, have a greater ability to rationalize harmful things to themselves. you know, people, the people who are running our society, they probably have a high IQ, you know, the evil people, but yeah, they rationalize that to themselves. It's not a, IQ isn't necessarily a tool for finding the truth or for finding goodness. No, it's for rationalizing whatever you want to do. I mean, the other things come from elsewhere, right? But absolutely. The point is that a lot of intelligent people use their intelligence as a way to rationalize their own self-doubt. Self-pity is a huge thing. You can just rationalize self-pity from here to the, you know, the next galaxy and be my guest, but it's not going to be good for you.
Indeed. And, you know, I think I was definitely guilty of that as a younger man. I think that this phenomenon of people rationalizing defeat is more more common than we often acknowledge. There was something that you said there that I was going to pick up on, but it's gone now. It was something about when you're young and, I can't remember what it was. That's really annoying. I hate when that happens, and it happens quite a lot now. But anyway, okay. Well, I guess we can move on to the questions. It was okay. All right. Is Scandinavia? This is from Orthodoxy Proxy. Is Scandinavia further along the way insofar as the cashless society, Great Reset conditions, etc.?
Well, the short answer is yes. There are many places, and this is a change that has happened in just a few years, just a couple of years, 2-3 years, that there are now many places in Scandinavia where you're not able to pay with cash. You have to use a card. You have to use a credit card. And that's just, and it seems like many new cafes and restaurants and new shops and things like that open up, they will do that, right? So in the older places, you can still pay with cash. But the newer places, they will go for a cashless solution. Whereas if you go to Southern Europe, you will find many places that still prefer cash, where, you know, they don't want to bother with, you know, with the credit cards, even in some places in you know, Eastern Europe and Southern Europe, where you pay your bills in cash, right? You pay your rent in cash. That's not the common way to do it in Northern Europe. In Scandinavia, for example, paying your rent in cash, that would be seen as very unusual. So that's one thing. Yes, so Scandinavia is definitely further along the way to a cashless society. And the sort of Great Reset conditions, one of the reasons Sweden didn't have a lockdown is that Swedes got the vax voluntarily. You don't have to, because it's a high trust society, people will go along with government directives, and they don't have to make a legal to force you legally to do it, because they'll just say, well, we have this recommendation. And I think that's especially true in Sweden. You know, basically, when you're born in Sweden, the social democratic government sends out an instruction manual for how you're going to live your life. It's sort of like IKEA. It's IKEA society. You get an assembly sort of instruction manual. This is how you're going to live your life, and that's, you know, people go along with it. It's a fucking bizarre society, I have to say. I love it in some ways. I mean, it, to Sweden's credit, I think other systems would have collapsed long ago with the same kind of pressure from just sheer stupidity. But it's a well-oiled machine, so it just keeps on going. I mean, it's to Sweden's credit, but there's so much insanity going on in Scandinavia, yeah.
I've remembered what it was that I was going to bring up based on what you'd said. It was about the question of intelligence, IQ, and so on. And I do basically equate IQ. I mean, for the purposes of this discussion, I would just equate IQ and intelligence, because otherwise it'll take ages to discuss this. It's very easy to fetishize intelligence and celebrate it, and because it is fairly rare. You know, there are a lot of people who simply aren't very bright, and you cannot have it's true. So a lot of things, a lot of understandings and ideas are simply not available to them, and you cannot get them to interact with that stuff. So therefore, when you meet someone who can, it's obviously that's valuable, it's precious. But at the same time, intelligence alone is not enough. Because as you were saying, there are plenty of intelligent people who are completely deluded, whether due to their own reasons, their own motivations, or because of their society. And then there are intelligent people who are rebellious, independent, and yet they still get things wrong, despite their high intelligence. I mean, there are people who are highly intelligent, but also, you know, maladjusted. You and I know quite a few people like that. We've talked about them. So, intelligence alone is not, it's not sufficient. It's useful, but it's important not to think, and I don't think many people really would make this mistake, but it's important not to fetishize it, to assume that if someone is intelligent, then they are a useful person. Unfortunately, it's not the case. And also, if you are an intelligent person, it's important not to have too high an opinion of yourself based on that alone, because you might have other terrible qualities. And also, you might never have used that intelligence productively, in which case you should really be ashamed of having it, because you've squandered it.
Yeah.
So I would say, I don't want to get people down. I'm saying, you know, if you do have this thing, then it's a sort of moral duty, I think, to use it as well as you can in your life.
There are plenty of high IQ idiots around, plenty of them, too many of them. Just look at the field of postmodernism and the Frankfurt School and all the pseudo-intellectual movements where people use their high IQ to rationalize stupidity. I think there's a he's a medical professor, so an intellectual. I forget his exact field. I think his name was Charlton. He wrote an article, scientific article. I forget when, like early 2000s, about clever sillies, as he called them, basically about why high IQ people are so stupid. And you know, there are certain fields of science which take a high IQ. I mean, if you're going to do physics, if you're going to do maths, if you're going to do theoretical philosophy, it takes a lot of brain power to understand these things, and you have to be clever in order to do it successfully. But there are other fields that don't take too much intelligence to deal with them. I mean, political science doesn't. I mean, it's pretty common sense how it actually works, because we're human beings and we can understand. I mean, you can make elaborate theories. The point is that, well, that gives room for people making very elaborate theories that are just stupid, but it's just a huge circular argument that just takes a lot of intelligence to feed into it, and you can impress your colleagues, and you can get promotions. That's how a lot of social science subjects work, through clever sillies, people who have a high IQ, but they use their high IQ to rationalize stupidity. That's how a lot of social science works. So, you know, there are even people in the scientific field talking about this problem with high IQ people just talking about stupid things, because, you know, they need to do something. If you're going to be a professor, if you're going to have 1,000 professors in social science, what are they going to do? They have to write something. Well, then they have to write these bullshit papers. Because what else are they going to do?
Yeah. God, what a situation where you actually have to give them crap to do in order to use up their intelligence. That's so sad.
It's pretty dystopian.
It really is. It really is. Okay. Frody, will eugenics and racial science of the early 20th century be reappraised in the future? Or is this too discredited after 1945? I'm thinking in particular of James Watson, who co-discovered DNA, and then he got blacklisted, and I think his Nobel Prize was rescinded or something like that.
Mm-hmm. He actually sold, they didn't take his prize away. He just sold his medal in disgust because he was so attacked by the medical community. I don't think his prize was actually revoked, but you know, this was probably more than 10 years ago now, so I might recall it incorrectly. But yeah, he was attacked. I mean, he was a Nobel Prize winner. He's one of the most prominent scientists in the last 100 years, and he just said what, you know, every scientist in the field knows, that he said that he has, you know, he doesn't see a very bright future because for Africa, because they have this ceiling on what IQ levels they can reach. And the fact is that in a modern society, modern bureaucratic high-tech society, you're going to need something above 90 IQ to survive and just be a normal person, because that's what it takes to, you know, fill all the forms and you know, do all the paperwork, that it, you know, it's not a simple society anymore. And I think it's horrible, but that's just the way it is. I don't like this society. I'm a primitivist in many ways, because I just think that this is against our nature. In any case, aside from Watson, yeah, I absolutely, there's no way around eugenics and IQ science, things like that. There's no way around that. And the fact of the matter is that in the scientific field itself, it is less controversial than it is in public. And what I mean by this is that if you actually talk to researchers who do research on IQ or whatever, it's less controversial. But the point is that the journalists choose to interview only certain scientists, right? So that the general public will get a false impression, while the scientists in the field will actually know a lot more, and they will, you know, realize that, well, we have to accept certain facts. You know, some won't accept it, but what I mean is that there's a difference between the scientific field and the general public. And the general public, whatever the general public hears, will always be filtered through a journalist filter, and the journalists will pick and choose. You know, you could have 100 scientists, and 99 of them will say that, you know, they will agree with common sense views on race and IQ, but the one guy who says that no, that's not true, the journalists will always interview that guy, right? So they will always go for the most extreme. So that's how they push the narrative. So yeah, but you know, absolutely, eugenics will have a place in the future, just as a scientific field. I don't think there's any way around it. I think we'll have to deal with it. And one thing that some people point out is that countries like China are already using eugenics to get an advantage, a competitive advantage against us. So, I mean, either we have to start using it as well, or they're going to eat us for breakfast, right? Yeah. They're just going to have an advantage. And another thing I want to point out, just a brief other point with that question, is that with respect to, because the person asking mentioned 1945, the, you know, obviously the National Socialist regime in Germany, and they did not talk a lot about eugenics. That's actually a false thing. It was far, far more common in America, in Scandinavia, and other places. Eugenics itself was not a huge thing in the Third Reich. They were talking about racial purity and so on, but eugenics as a topic was not a huge thing. So that's actually a false impression in the post-war world, in the narrative, that it's because of the Third Reich that we don't talk about eugenics. They didn't actually talk about it that much.
No, but it is something that has been attached to the Third Reich in order to demonize it.
Yes, so, that's true.
And it works both ways. Okay, there are quite a few other questions.
I can just add just a one sentence thing. there's a Jewish writer called John Glad who has written about eugenics, and he has talked basically about these things. He's written for a popular sort of audience. So he doesn't write for other scientists. He writes to popularize the topic. And he has talked about this. And he's not pro-NS in any way. So yeah, if you want to learn more about eugenics, I think that's a good place to start. John Glad.
Okay. Harold says, individualism with consequences selects for more responsible people. Yeah, I mean, this is the thing where it's high intelligence, high IQ, plus conscientiousness. And then those two things, and you've basically got wonderful people. Part of what made Europeans the way they are was using the nuclear family model for the last 500 years, which is more individualistic than living with extended family. Is there anything you want to say about that, Frody?
I don't really understand the question.
I don't think it's a question. I think he's just remarking on.
Yeah, I think that's true. High IQ and it's a high trust society. High trust societies are wonderful. That's high trust societies are the kind of societies that other people want to move to, but it's also the kind of society that other people can take advantage of. And you know, maybe it's not sustainable. And it probably isn't, not in a multicultural context. So if we want high conscientiousness, high trust society, high IQ society, we have to create ethnostates again. I mean, that's the only logical conclusion.
Yeah. Okay. Christopher Langan has the highest IQ in America. I can't remember. I think it was 165. No. Anyway, it was a sky high IQ.
Yep.
And he never did well as an academic. He actually was a weightlifter and worked as a bouncer. He's pretty active on Twitter, and I think he was a Trump supporter for a time. And I can say that I did contact him for this millennial to see if he would like to appear. And his secretary said that he doesn't do live streams, but she's trying to get him into them. So maybe next year, who knows? But the thing about, I actually read an article, an essay somewhere about it contrasted Christopher Langan with one of the atomic bomb scientists. I think it was Oppenheimer, who had tried to poison his lecturer at university. His university lecturer, and yet his parents had managed to get him. It's incredible. His parents had managed to persuade the university not to involve the law. So, because obviously, if the law had got involved, his life would have been wrecked, rightly. But because they managed to persuade him that not to happen, he was able to have to continue at university, get a good degree, and then have a career in science. It's astounding. And they were Jews. They were high verbal IQ, high social intelligence. And so they were able to persuade. They were good at the art of persuasion. They were good at the art of negotiation. Now, the essay, according to this essay that I read, mm-hmm. and the essay contrasted that with Christopher Langan, who came from a working class white background, and they don't have this. They don't tend to have the social intelligence. And of course, this is how you end up with so many Spergs and Neets among you know, that they're intelligent, but they don't have that social noose, which is very necessary. I mean, something I've realized over the last few years is how a lot of things that happen because somebody met someone else and had a conversation. It's not mm-hmm. because the thing doesn't happen because it's a great idea or because it's mm-hmm. the most effective idea or whatever. It happens because it was pushed socially by by someone who could do that. It happens because of certain negotiation. So Christopher Langan, I think, dropped out of university. He fell out with a tutor or something like that. I can't remember now. So in spite of his high IQ, he was thwarted by other elements of his character and his background. And so, again, I would say that this underlines that intelligence is not enough. And what's more, if you do have it, then you want to protect it and facilitate it by making sure that other things are in order, namely that you know how to write a letter, you know how to negotiate without losing your temper, you know whom to contact in an organization and how to successfully get to that person. These sorts of things, which, and again, to a well-meaning, naive white person, you wouldn't even think about needing that skill. And certainly to an autistic person, it would never occur that you would need that skill. But in the real world, if you do have those skills, then you will get ahead far better than if you don't.
I mean, it brings us back to the clever sillies, right? I mean, if you have a very high IQ, what are you going to use that surplus IQ for? I mean, it's just going to be a burden. at some point, I think at some point, very high IQ can become maladaptive. I think many high IQ people become, they become antisocial. They become, it just becomes a hindrance. And, you know, a person like Ted Kaczynski comes to mind, stratospheric, super high IQ, very intelligent, and was pretty maladjusted. He wasn't a very social guy, and you know, it led to some dreadful consequences and some great literature. But, I did an interview with David Scarbina, who is probably the person who has exchanged most letters with Ted Kaczynski. I did an interview with him about, you know, the Unabomber and just technological slavery and how high tech society ruins us. I mean, it just ruins our world, our life world. We end up serving technology rather than technology serving us. You know, we see consequences of that now. But yeah, absolutely, high IQ. This sort of high IQ fetishism is sort of stupid. It's ridiculous. It's sort of like fetishizing height. I mean, yeah, a person can be born freakishly tall. You can be like 2.5 meters. Is that great? No, I mean, you're a freak. I mean, and it's the same thing if you have an IQ that is like the double of everyone around you. Well, what use is that going to be to you, right? I mean, you're just going to end up being antisocial. It's not an unambiguous positive to have a high IQ.
Yeah, it comes with a price, let's see. And as I said, it's not enough on its own, even for Christopher Langan. You know, even he... the other things, his high IQ didn't compensate for the other things that were holding him down. So that's a very good example of this. Okay, Frody, how long do you think this plus one vaccine will continue? Always another vaccine. How long do you think that will continue for? It seems something which falls within the laws of diminishing returns. Surely someday the masses will awaken.
Well, So the vaccine, I mean, this is something that I've talked about as well, that they, you know, the mysterious they, our elites, the people running our society, they never give you the full truth right away, right? Because they knew from the start that the vaccine is only good for a couple of months. They knew that the effect goes away after a couple of months. They knew that. They knew that it's not going to, you know, it's not a lasting effect. So the conclusion is that if you're going to have this vaccine, I don't think it's necessary, but if you're going to have this vaccine on a mass scale, that means you have to update it every 2-3 months, because after that, the effect is gone. And how long are people going to put up with this? Another thing that I pointed out is that, and this is the dishonest thing, right? They said, you know, if you get the vaccine, you're everything's going to go back to normal. And then people get the vaccine, and then you say, well, 6 months later, you have, and they sort of, they nudge it in, right? It's sort of like, I'm not going to say, it was a bad analogy. I'm not going to use it, but they say that, yeah, after 6 months, you have to take a sort of a refill thing. And then, yeah, and then they just become a little bit more honest. Now, actually, after 3 months. And 3 months is probably the right number. So that means you have to take 3-4 injections per year. Now, you don't need it. Kids definitely don't need it. If you're a young, healthy person, you probably don't need it. And making it mandatory, yeah, maybe. You know, maybe they can continue doing it. But the point is that it's going to be 4 injections per year. Now, one thing that I've pointed out is that when they did the research on the injection and to see if it's safe or not, did they do it on one injection or on 10? Because that's not necessarily the same thing. I mean, the health risk connected with one injection and the health risk associated with 10 injections is not necessarily the same thing.
Yeah, the poison is in the dose. So exactly. Is that not the first law of toxicology?
Yeah, I mean, and this is the thing. And I've asked people, I've asked JF, I've asked other people, do we know if this is a sort of if there's a compound effect, if there's a cumulative effect of the danger associated with the injection? And the point is that they haven't done the research. They haven't done the research of risks associated with this before they launched it upon a couple of billion people, right? I think that how long can this go on? I think the answer to that question depends a little bit on if we're gonna see massive health consequences, massive dangers associated with this, because we just don't know the long-term effects yet. And that's why it's not prudent, in my opinion, my humble amateur opinion, I don't think it's prudent to take something that you don't need and that you don't know the long-term consequences of. Coronaviruses have existed for a very long time. They haven't created any vaccine before this that has a lasting effect, and this obviously doesn't have a lasting effect. So yeah, I don't know. Maybe it will. What I see is most likely, if I'm going to be a cynic, is that they're going to keep this up for a while, and then maybe a year or two from now, they're going to say that, well, I think the coronavirus is pretty much under control. Then they're going to move over to the next thing, right? The next thing that you need to get a vaccination for. And because you need to keep the vaccine card going. You need to have, okay, well, we need to fill in something there because I think they're going to want to continue this control grid. But the point is, I don't want to make any very specific predictions because, like I said, in the beginning, that I think we should go on the evidence. And right now, the evidence shows that these people, if we're looking at human health, this is enormously irrational from many perspectives, not just like the injection. Keeping people locked up, like in a prison for years, what's that doing to kids? What's this doing to kids, to the brains of kids? I can see in myself that just from the rolling back my natural social life to a much lower level than is normal, that which has been under these 2 years, I think it's had an impact on me. And you know, a lot of people have been in a lot worse situations than I have. And how has this impacted their mental health? How has it impacted children's brains? Don't come out, you know, when they're born, fully developed, they develop. if you traumatize the brain, or if you push it in a certain direction, it will impact how the brain develops. So what are the long-term consequences of all this abuse that we've suffered in the last 2 years? I mean, we don't know that yet. So yes. Yeah, we can only speculate.
Yes, indeed. Okay, do you believe a form of pre-Christian polytheism can be resuscitated amidst the seeming collapse of Christianity in Europe? And try to answer this briefly, because there are a lot of questions left that we need to get through.
Okay, well, I'll just give a very brief answer. I don't think so on a mass scale, probably not in you know, our lifetimes. I am personally a pagan. I have many friends who are pagans, 100% on board. I think it's going to be sort of... an elite group are probably going to be a part of that. For the masses, probably not.
All right. Merry Christmas to you. This is from Barther. Merry Christmas to you, Woz, and I don't know how to pronounce this, but it looks like Gletelig Yul to you, Frodi. You two have done an amazing job for our people. Thank you very much. And I wish you to have a great Yule season filled with blessings from the gods above. Be prepared for 2022. It will not be pretty. Start saving US dollars because it will go up a lot. All right. Well, thank you very much. I'm not sure about why the dollar would go up. But anyway,
I expect probably the dollar to go in a different direction, but thank you very much for that.
And how is that pronounced? What looks like Glettelig Yule?
Well, it's Faroe. It's Glettelig Yule. You could say it any ways, but yeah, Glettelig Yule is what I would say in Faroese, okay. Or God Jul in Swedish, or yeah. Let's just stop it there.
Okay. I just want to pronounce it vaguely correctly.
You do.
Otherwise, it seems impolite not to try. Okay.
Very phonetic. I mean, Scandinavian languages are pretty phonetic, that they you write them as they are pronounced. So,
right. Okay. Isn't Epstein's predilection for Norse purity a typification of... Yeah, I'd rather not ask that that question on air. But Aryan bride gathering cult scenario, yeah, probably.
I get your point, yes.
Okay, Bane of Crenshaw says, goth is just a way for ugly chicks to cover it up with thick, dark makeup. Well, I disagree vehemently with that statement, which I am a fan of goth girls, and so on. So I'm on team goth girl.
I mean, pretty girls can get away with anything.
I will defend them to the ends of the earth. of course, pretty girls, absolutely. Could sports ball be replaced with something similar that was not anti-white, maybe a shooting sport or something more based? Well, I mean, the short answer to that is yes. But it would depend on power. It would depend on having the power in society to do that. Otherwise, it's just, I mean, it's all theoretical. And of course, anything can be replaced with whatever we want if we are in power. But if we're not, then it's irrelevant. Okay. Let me see. Ah, yes. Your interview with Greg Johnson took the words out of my mouth. A lot of us are becoming crypto rich very soon. Well, I hope so. And that's why I do suggest that people get into crypto if they can. Be prepared for a generous offer from a guy on his yacht to come and talk business. Do you guys have a plan? Well, I haven't received communications from any yacht owners recently, but maybe it will happen in the near future. I do think that people should be getting into crypto. I do think it is a potential way for people who don't have much in the way of worldly resources to gain some. Why would you not do that if you could? Now, that's not to say that you're guaranteed to make a lot of money from crypto. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying it is a way that you could get onto that, into that game. And it is a game, you know. I'm not going to say it's just a gold rush.
I would just suggest to people to familiarize themselves with how it works. I mean, even if you don't invest a whole lot of money, just to get a feel for how it actually works is probably going to be very useful for you in the future. That's all I can say.
Someone said, "Call it Millennium Yacht." Very good. And as for do you guys have a plan? I certainly have things like ideas for things that could be done in the real world. But you know, I think we all do. But these are for now fairly fanciful notions, without the ability to actually enact them. If we had resources, there are tons of things that we could be doing to make a tangible effect in the real world. So. I think that's all of those questions, and then I'll go to Entropy. Bannerman says, "Happy Christmas." Thank you very much, and that is a generous donation. Thank you. Archie says, "The mRNA vaccine nudges people to getting comfy with being GMOs in a genetic modification." Now, I should say, there was a CEO from one of the drug companies who there was a clip of him about 2 weeks ago, and he actually referred, in that clip, he refers to the vaccine as gene therapy. Now, this is something that has been, when the conspiracy theorists have called it gene therapy, they have been reviled and mocked for saying that. But here is a guy very high up in the drugs companies saying that now. Of course, it's just one clip, and maybe he misspoke, perhaps. But anyway, The mRNA vax nudges people to getting comfy with genetic modification. In a population that's 100% vaccinated, new hot strains will keep appearing, and so lockdowns and mask mandates will have no end. A real gene therapy that cures by modifying humans will be introduced. Desperate people will become GMO humans. And then he says at the end, Schwab, as if that whole thing is a quote from Klaus Schwab, but I very much doubt that it is. Look, it's too late in the night for me to speculate on something that involved, so forgive me if I don't. But I take the point that the mRNA vaccine is a new thing, and it opens the field to lots of new possibilities that we can't even guess at. It makes everything more complicated. And we've seen this with the interplay between the vaccine numbers and the case numbers and the infection, and the death numbers. It's, and the side effects, which are now being blamed on COVID itself, but they seem to occur in people who have been vaccinated. It's all very confusing and murky, and I think deliberately so. Now, whether they're doing that so as to push genetic modification, I don't know. I'm not going to say that. I'm not going to declare that. And then finally, Gallic Nord says, "Faithless is he that says farewell when the road darkens." Tolkien. Here, that's
Gimli, right?
I don't know. I'm not familiar with Tolkien. Here's a financial gift. Happy Christmas, good yule to you both, and to all in the chat. Thank you very much, Gallic Nord. Okay, I think that's all the questions. So, yeah, we actually got through them fairly quickly. I thought it was going to take longer. Dr. Schwab, or How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Vax. All right, thank you. Okay, so, Frody, is there anything you'd like to say before we finish?
Well, I think this has been a great conversation. I want to thank you so much. I want to thank, you know, everyone who's been watching as well, and everyone who has supported your works, Woz, and everyone who's supported my work throughout the year. And I think that, you know, we have to be very persistent. And I think things are moving in the right direction for us, in the sense that more and more intelligent people are coming to our side all the time. And it's quality that matters in the long run. So I think that even if people don't see immediate results, they shouldn't lose faith, because this is a change that's going to take a very long time. And even if we don't change things like within the next decade or whatever in the entire society, we can still create good things for ourselves. We can still push things in the right direction. So I think people should be aware of that. And if there's one thing that I can suggest with regard to the whole COVID narrative and the flu world order and all of that, is that just as with the, if you're talking about Jewish influence or anything else that's sort of a controversial topic, there's enough information that is verifiable to make it interesting, right? We can say interesting things on verifiable evidence. So we don't have to speculate. And I would recommend that people do the same thing with COVID, that the situation is bad enough with all the things that we can verify and we can prove. So we don't have to speculate about all kinds of weird, wild things about what is the final end goal of these, you know, evil overlords. If we just talk about the bad things they've done, you know, they want to remove one of the core principles of medical ethics in the West. It's a cornerstone of medical ethics in the West, and that is informed consent. That is a bad thing. And just the fact that, I mean, they can violate your integrity online or violate your integrity wherever with surveillance cameras. If they can puncture your skin and get inside your body and inject a chemical substance inside your body, if they can violate the skin, so they're inside you, it's sort of a coerced penetration, as I called it. If they can do that, then you have no integrity left. I think let's start with those things. If we can start with those things and make people realize that this is a pretty bad thing,
if they can violate that integrity without your consent. That's pretty bad. So let's stick with those things and push those talking points rather than speculate too much, because that only reduces your own credibility, and I don't think it really flies, and especially not with very intelligent people. So that's my only recommendation to people. But I want to wish everyone a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. I'm going to do a live stream tomorrow before Millennial. It's not going to interfere with Millennial. I'm going to do a live stream together with American Krogan tomorrow on my channel on Culture Lodge Radio. So we're going to talk more then. So if anyone wants to check that out, you can go to my Telegram, Guide to Culture, and support Millennial Woes. I think this is an effort that should be rewarded. I mean, if we want our own media, then we have to support our own media. I mean, if you rather want Netflix, then you support Netflix. If you want this, if you want more of this, you support this. That's my message. Thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you for saying that, Frode. And it is true that, you know, I don't know what a Netflix subscription costs, but the same amount would probably make a much bigger difference to me than it would to the CEO of Netflix, or even the low-level staff of Netflix. Now, I should have said that previous super chat came from someone called Paladin, and it was a very generous donation, so I should have acknowledged that. I didn't see the amount when I was reading out the question about crypto, so thank you for that, Paladin. All right, now I will be back very soon with Charlemagne, and that should be a good discussion based on the notes that he sent me. It should be very interesting. So in the meantime, Frode Medjord, thank you for taking part in Millennial 2021.
Good Yule, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year.
Okay. Good Yule, Merry Christmas, and Happy New Year to you as well, Frode. I'll be back very soon. Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye.
Millennial Woes has created many things, and this is your chance to own one of them. A unique piece of work handcrafted by the Vile Vlogger to commemorate Millennial 2021. 100 hours of highly skilled labor went into producing this animated vector graphic, which can be magnified to any size. In the iconic Millennial Woes font, it glistens and responds to your touch. And at the center of it all, a figure representative of 2021, the White Stag, symbolizing endurance, discovery, and rejuvenation. This one-of-a-kind creation is up for sale as an NFT. Follow the link below, and it can be yours forever. This is your only chance.